You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Much has changed in New York City in the 50 years since Jane Jacobs wrote her seminal book about urban planning, The Death and Life of American Cities. Neighborhoods including Soho and Harlem in Manhattan and Williamsburg and Red Hook in Brooklyn, once industrial poor and considered by city officials as prime locations to build new highways or high-rise developments, are now prized as authentic and are among the city's hottest and most expensive places to live and to shop. Sharon Zuckin, a sociology professor at Brooklyn College, explains how that very concept of authenticity has been turned into a marketing tool that's helped transform gritty into trendy in her latest book, Naked City. It's published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought her back to our show today. Hello.
Hello, I'm delighted to be here.
Now, Naked City was the name of a movie in 1948 directed by Jules Dassin. He was on the show. I can't remember how he pronounced it. He won two Oscars, and then there was a TV series in the late 50s, early 60s. Why use it as the title of your book?
I saw the DVD of Dassin's film a few years ago, and I was very struck by how authentic the city seems in those old noir films. You know, partly it's the grittiness of the black and white film technology, film stock, but also it's the streets, it's the working class people who are serving in the diners and driving the taxis and even working as detectives in the police department. And
we had Needicks then.
Oh yes, lots of places that served cheap food on real china dishes. And I think that maybe when fast food places lost those cheap china dishes, we lost something of the authenticity of that time.
So you're saying that New York City seems less permanent and less authentic than it did in 1948?
Yes, and it's a paradoxical claim to make. I'm aware of that because New York City is always changing. A lot of the city tears itself down and builds itself up every few years. There are periodic real estate booms when the money comes in, the buildings go down, new buildings go up in their place, and people feel lost. I wanted to capture something that's different, something that's new, and an emotion that is rawer at this period when people really feel that their last contact with real New York is disappearing.
Although we have seen resistance after Penn Station, we developed the Landmarks Commission, and we preserved some neighborhoods, haven't we?
Well, we have definitely preserved the physical buildings, but what we risk losing is the real people who live in these neighborhoods. As housing prices go up, the people who we think provide the social diversity and ethnic character of our neighborhoods can't afford to live there anymore. Now, I know they're replaced by new groups, and as the demographer William Fry was just saying on Brian Lehrer's show, thank goodness we have new waves of immigrants coming in to replenish the vitality and small business of each neighborhood. But too many of the old groups are leaving, and many of the new groups can't stay in place.
Although I'm sure there are a fair number of people who are grateful that gentrification has made their neighborhood feel safer, nicer.
This is true. This is the upside, part of the upside of gentrification. The people who can afford to stay in the neighborhood are grateful for that. They're grateful for lower crime rates, but I think that those attract gentrifiers. They don't cause gentrification. There are other factors, some of which we know, some of which we don't know, that bring the crime rates down. People are grateful for better shopping opportunities, particularly in underserved neighborhoods where low-income groups and often ethnic minorities live.
Friends who live in Williamsburg and Greenpoint tell me about how pleased they are that all these new buildings that have gone up are pretty much empty. They can't rent them, and they felt like the neighborhood was going to hell, but they have won the ultimate victory.
I was afraid you were going to finish that sentence by saying people in Williamsburg are happy that the new buildings are going up, but yes, they...
No, that's not what I've been hearing.
No, exactly. You put your finger on the benefit of the economic recession, and that is that it has halted a lot of the new construction in neighborhoods that are going to be overwhelmed by tall buildings. So a lot of those very expensive new apartments are unrented or unbought. But Williamsburg was really done in by the rezoning that attracted developers to build tall buildings all along the waterfront.
Well, what about Atlantic Yards? Despite the fact that we are going through this economic hard time, the new basketball arena is going ahead. Just cleared another judicial hurdle.
Exactly. Just in the last couple of days, the courts decided that the right of eminent domain was properly used by the state, and the remaining residents on the site will have to be evicted. This is a really sore point, as you know. We've been discussing Atlantic Yards as a project to revitalize the center of Brooklyn for 5 or 6 or 7 years now.
And isn't it replacing some rather undistinguished buildings in a fairly blighted area?
Well, this is a problem because Atlantic Yards promises housing, it promises shopping, it promises entertainment facilities on the borders of different neighborhoods rather than in the center of an ongoing vibrant neighborhood. In fact, this was a spot that Robert Moses had in mind 50 or 60 years ago for some sort of urban renewal that would probably lead through a great boulevard to downtown Brooklyn.
Although he did prevent the Dodgers from building a new Ebbets Field there.
That's true. But maybe that was one of his wise decisions.
Well, do you think the problem is that there's a proposal to build stuff, or what eventually was proposed? For example, some years ago, I moderated a discussion with the Municipal Arts Society, and they said that they didn't oppose all urban renewal, but that they thought that the plan, which cut Brooklyn in two parts and made it very difficult for people to get from Fort Greene to Prospect Heights or whatever the other side of Atlantic Yards is, was really a poorly thought-out plan.
Absolutely. There's one problem with the project itself, the substance, the program of the project and the design. And there's another problem with process, of course. The first problem is that Atlantic Yards features overscale buildings for the center of Brooklyn. These buildings are totally out of character with the borough as a whole and certainly with the center. You don't put buildings like that right in the center of the city. You also don't put a giant attraction on top of a relatively small set of subway platforms. That's the arena. So,
although it is a place where all the subway lines converge.
They do, but if we really had urban planning in New York City, the way they do in some European countries, we would have had better streets built first. We would have had a tram line perhaps going throughout Brooklyn along Flatbush Avenue or one of the other avenues. We would have had schools built, and then we would have had the arena and the housing. So the oversized scale of these buildings, the placement of the buildings, the program, and the process, the lack of consultation from the ground up, these are all really grievous problems.
My guest is Sharon Zukin, Z-U-K-I-N, a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the City University of New York Graduate Center. She's written a number of books. Her most recent one, the one we are discussing, is Naked City, The Death and Life of Authentic Urban Places. It is published by Oxford University Press, and your subtitle suggests that you intend this book to be a kind of an update to Jane Jacobs' book.
Yes, both an update and an argument against those who want to make Jacobs into a saint while demolishing her ideals on the ground.
She moved to Toronto. has that city escaped what we are having here?
No, not completely. They have the same gentrified neighborhoods where first boutiques and then wealthier residents encroach on middle-income, low-income immigrant neighborhoods. They have giant upscale high-rise projects along the waterfront. In many ways, Toronto is more humane, as Jacobs noted back in the 60s. But the city suffers from some of the same competitive urges as New York.
Well, let's look at her legacy here. Haven't many of the ideas that Jane Jacobs put forward in 1960, like the desirability of preserving narrow streets, low-rise buildings, historic structures, become accepted wisdom in architectural and urban planning circles?
To some degree, that's completely true. Our City Planning Commission in New York swears up and down that they are apostles of Jacobs' ideas. But they have combined the grandiosity of Robert Moses with the love of small-scale streets and neighborhoods of Jane Jacobs by upscaling the avenues and downscaling the side streets.
On the other hand, they have kind of rejected the old Le Corbusier idea of the superblock construction, haven't they?
We will see. Atlantic Yards and the plans for the World Trade Center site do not dispense with those awful superblocks.
Well, you turned some pretty great phrases, and one I especially love that relates to this. You said, since 2008, a worldwide economic crisis has stilled the financial weapons of mass construction.
Thanks.
You must have had fun doing that.
I live to write, and I live in a fantastic city. Just every day walking around New York, you're struck by so many interesting, fabulous, significant problems.
Well, hadn't the somewhat messy urban environment that Jane Jacobs championed in 1960 already begun to disappear by the time her book was published because of changing social conditions in the city?
Yes, this is one of the arguments that I make in Naked City. I say that if you go back to the late 50s, early 60s, when Jane Jacobs wrote so beautifully about Hudson Street, where she lived, you would be aware of things that she did not pay any attention to, either because she wasn't interested or she was making a different sort of claim. The small shopkeepers whom she loved to watch and interact with, they represented the last part of a European immigration. They had a certain kind of social and economic and cultural capital that she doesn't talk about. Lack of capital investment for so many years in the part of the West Village where Jacobs lived, that was very important in a way to preserving the small scale. There was no development there. And may I just mention one more dirty word? Rent control. Hmm. She didn't think about the financial conditions that would keep residents and small shopkeepers in place.
But people also moving away from where they grew up and moving to the suburbs from the 50s on. And I guess the question is, when did it become apparent that just preserving the physical character or the architecture of an established neighborhood wasn't enough to preserve its way of life?
I think it took time for Jacobs' ideas to become the aesthetic agenda of gentrifiers. I think that it wasn't until the 1980s that gentrification in many cities, not just New York, reached a tipping point. At that time, people had really internalized Jacobs' values, and they said, we want to reject the sterility of the suburbs. I mean, people had talked about that in the 50s and the 60s, the little tacky boxes and so on, the homogeneity of the suburbs. But it wasn't until the next generation of the 80s, you know, after the hippies, after the artists and the Sohoization of artist districts all over the world, that people began to act in big numbers on Jacobs' ideas. And they said, we don't want to live in the suburbs. We want to recreate that small town feel.
But well before she died in 2006, it had become clear that landmarking city neighborhoods like Soho or Park Slope, Brooklyn, in order to preserve their character, accelerated their gentrification.
That's true.
Did she ever talk about what I assume were the unintended consequences of the historic preservation movement? She was talking about helping poor people, wasn't she?
No, she wasn't talking about helping poor people. She was talking about helping poor neighborhoods. And by unslumming, as she called it, unslumming poor neighborhoods, she felt that the people themselves would be helped. It's an interesting question whether unslumming is very much like gentrification. After all, in neighborhoods like Harlem, there has always been a working class and a middle class of African Americans who were unslumming their own neighborhood before gentrifiers, black and white, began to move in.
In fact, the word gentrification in places like Harlem often means white people moving in, even though that isn't really necessary for gentrification.
No, absolutely not. Gentrification is a class thing, and it's an income thing, and it's a problem of cultural capital, as we sociologists call it, where the new people who move in have different tastes from longtime residents.
We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. My guest is Sharon Zukin. Her latest book, Naked City, The Death and Life of Authentic Urban Places, published by Oxford University Press. Stay with us. We are back with Sharon Zukin, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the City University of New York Graduate Center, author of a number of books, including Loft Living, Landscapes of Power, which was the winner of the C. Wright Mills Award, The Cultures of Cities, and Point of Purchase. Her most recent is Naked City, The Death and Life of Authentic Urban Places, published by Oxford University Press. Jane Jacobs didn't use the word authentic to describe the neighborhood she was concerned about, but hasn't that become something of the buzzword today?
Absolutely. You can see authentic in Dunkin' Donuts advertisements. You can see it on shop signs. And it's a word that's very, very used in cultural criticism, theater reviews, books, maybe not movies so much because of the medium. But it's a word that resonates with people's desires right now, especially with younger people.
Why? Why do you think authentic is important? I mean, we hear about authentic cuisines today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know what that means either.
Well, it's a good question, of course. I think that it's one of those times when people feel more than ever that we live in a very unstable world, when identities are uncertain. People are moving from place to place. We are all foreigners and all strangers, and we grasp at whatever seems real to us, whether we're looking for a place to live or a yogurt.
Well, authenticity means something very specific, but can it be twisted into a marketing tool that can control the look and use of urban spaces?
Well, absolutely. Marketers talk about authentic experiences, and old buildings, cobblestone streets, small shops, they give the sense of authenticity that visually looks right.
A listener wants to ask about Hell's Kitchen, which he feels is an example of a New York City neighborhood that has retained some of its authenticity. That's not my sense.
Well,
Manhattan Plaza changed it a lot.
New York is becoming upscale in three senses that threaten Hell's Kitchen and every other neighborhood. Number one, the buildings are getting taller, like the building that you mentioned. Number two, everything is getting more expensive, and life is getting more upscale in that way. And number three, our everyday needs are becoming dependent on chain stores and other sorts of institutions that have a much larger scale of operations. So Hell's Kitchen, which even risks losing its name, it's supposed to be, you know, renamed Clinton, right?
Mm-hmm. They named the two neighborhoods after the former president's daughter, Chelsea Clinton.
Absolutely. I think maybe the naming went
Chelsea used to be a neighborhood nobody wanted to go to. Now
that's true.
It's one of the hottest neighborhoods in New York.
Well, you know, hot often means boutiques, art galleries, restaurants, and high housing prices.
Well, how much what role have the media played in those changes that we've seen, what you call lifestyle journalism?
The media are extremely important in directing attention to undiscovered neighborhoods. After all, the media depend on discovering what's new and telling the public about that. We can't help it. You know, probably from the earliest days, media have always done this. But now people are in a position, have been at least before the recession, in a position to move to the hot neighborhoods, to take for themselves as their restaurant neighborhoods or their retail shopping excursions or their housing, to take areas that had been off the radar and make them their own.
Time Out New York has regular issues on the hot neighborhood, but you also see those things in the New York Times and in New York Magazine, glamorizing local shops and restaurants where residents can buy authentic products or eat so-called authentic ethnic food at a bargain.
Well, absolutely. Again, authenticity, as you say, has become a buzzword of our time. And, you know, some people try to move away from it and say, oh, no, not me. I'm not interested in authenticity. But at bottom in our hearts, we really are. We want the real. And, you know, it's not just the media. It's all of us whose tastes are changing. It's amazing when you look at the neighborhood blogs in New York City, in Brooklyn, for example, where people say, oh, I love this neighborhood, but I really wish there were a place to get a good cup of coffee. Not the cups of coffee that are currently being prepared in the diners, but a cappuccino, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. They want the Starbucks to move near them as well.
It could be the Starbucks or the, you know, the little espresso shop.
But when an undiscovered neighborhood is branded as authentic, doesn't the process of gentrification follow?
Absolutely.
So we see that in Sunset Park to some degree. Williamsburg went through it earlier. I'm not sure how much Greenpoint is an authentic neighborhood, although it is very strong Polish sensibility. How much of that is just the spillover from Williamsburg? And now that Greenpoint has become rather expensive, Long Island City receiving the spillover from Greenpoint.
There has been that kind of migration since the 1980s, at least, when artists were priced out of Soho. They went to the East Village, then they went to Williamsburg, then they moved to Bushwick and Flatbush, and I don't think they're moving to Nassau County, but there has been that eastward migration.
Red Hook for a while was suggested as the next hot place. I have to tell you, I lived in Red Hook for a while. And until they get decent public transportation, that neighborhood will never really boom. It became rather depressing because restaurants kept on going out of business.
It's a problem if you're as geographically isolated as Red Hook is. I think that the neighborhoods that are really hot neighborhoods are easy to get to on public transportation, and they're also close to media centers and where media people live.
Is it ironic that you were quoted by Patricia Marks in her story in the current issue of The New Yorker about shopping in Brooklyn?
No, I think that's entirely appropriate because I do place a lot of emphasis on the role of consumer culture in making neighborhoods hot.
Mayor Bloomberg announced this morning that New York City would launch a new week-long culture festival to attract visitors and encourage them to spend their money. Are these sorts of campaigns anything new?
No. Certainly culture capitals have lured visitors for many, many years. And the current worldwide trend of declaring certain cities culture capitals of the year and encouraging artists to create public sculptures and public events like the gates in Central Park or the waterfalls in the East River.
Did you like them or no? Because there was a lot of public debate over the gates, for example. I thought they were perfectly fine because they were temporary. The waterfall was a problem because it destroyed all of the greenery alongside the river. But for a little while, I guess, it drew people to the city and our museums Some of the greatest museums in the world draw people to the city. This has to only be good for the city. Tourism pays an awful lot of bills, doesn't it?
Tourism is one of our major industries. It would be great to bring back some industries where we actually make things also.
How does creating more opportunities for culture help reinvest cities with a sense of authenticity?
Culture works in different ways. When you have these festivals and public art events, they get reproduced all over the world. And eventually, there are too many of these festivals. You don't know where you are just because you're at one of these public art festivals. So, you know, what I really like is the culture that comes out of New York neighborhoods.
I've always wondered about those film festivals. Oh, now another, you know, Omaha is now going to have an international film festival. You point out that since 2001, Americans have become preoccupied with shopping and security. Are we more comfortable if our culture is homogenized and familiar?
To some degree we are, but in our hearts we feel unease because we lose our identity.
But you talk about the McGuggenization of culture. What do you mean by that?
I have to confess that is not my original term, but I have lifted it from a geographer. When every city around the world tries to attract tourists to a spectacular museum, usually a modern art museum, not an old art museum, you have a kind of McDonald's for the educated classes. And everybody says, oh, we've got to go to this museum. It's on our itinerary. And then you literally have a standardization of high culture.
But McDonald's isn't hip. Doesn't visiting a public art institution, a festival, a modern art museum, or a hipster district make a visitor feel safe, but also in the know?
Yes, but when everybody feels in the know, then where's the avant-garde?
I've wondered about what has changed. Why has Brooklyn become a place to come to rather than the place to come from?
This is a really interesting question of history and social change. Until the 1970s or 1980s, the ethnic communities of the European immigration in Brooklyn were very strong. Also, the West Indian communities were very strong. And the writers and artists who emerged at that time rebelled against the limitations of those communities as well as the limitations of their families. And they wanted to get to the big city. They wanted to leave Brooklyn and see the wide world, starting with Manhattan. But in the 1980s, so many Americans found Manhattan to be too big, too impersonal, and they found themselves, maybe they found the small town past in the leafy streets and smaller houses of Brooklyn.
Now, in those older days, Brooklyn Heights was the one exception in Brooklyn because it was almost an extension of Manhattan. Now, Brooklyn Heights seems to be somewhat on the decline. It doesn't have any of the hot new restaurants. It doesn't have decent shopping because it is seen as part of Manhattan.
Well, this is an interesting question when you get down to the ground level of individual neighborhoods. Housing prices in Brooklyn Heights are very high, and I'm sure commercial rents on Montague Street, the main shopping street in that area, are very high. So that a new experimental kind of boutique, a new restaurant trying out new kinds of cuisine, they're not going to open up in Brooklyn Heights. They're going to go to a neighborhood where the rents are lower and the population is still pretty diverse, and there are young people with lower incomes who will support a more experimental kind of artisanal production.
Now, you say that gentrification is too narrow a term for the changes that have taken place in Brooklyn. Would you call it?
I would even call it upscaling or re-urbanization, where you're turning the city inside out. You're reversing the flight of middle-class populations from the mid-20th century. You're bringing people back into the city and concentrating them in old areas that had experienced decline. So I really see the city being turned inside out not just gentrified.
Is this something that's happening in other boroughs? People are moving to Queens and to the Bronx. I'm not sure about Staten Island, whether it just remains a kind of a stable neighborhood, although certain ethnic groups have chosen to move there. But is all we ever talk about is Brooklyn?
Maybe that's because so many media people live in Brooklyn.
I take that as a criticism of me and 98% of all the people in public radio?
And 98% of all people in publishing, probably. Brooklyn is big. There are more than 30 neighborhoods in Brooklyn. It's such a populous part of the city that if it were an independent city, I think it would be the fourth largest city in the U.S. So there's a lot going on in Brooklyn, and there really have been a lot of concentrations of new cultural producers in Brooklyn.
Well, I always thought of Queens as the borough of the middle class, but isn't gentrification a sign of an expanding middle class?
Not necessarily expanding middle class, but expanding upper middle class. Remember, too, that Queens was largely built up after the 1960s, so that you have a lot of those new houses that would not attract gentrifiers, relatively new houses, kind of undistinguished apartment houses, that would not attract standard gentrifiers. As more neighborhoods in Queens and elsewhere become historic landmark districts, the architecture will be reevaluated, and more people will see a beauty in Queens that doesn't have to do with wide streets and green lawns and new housing, but a more historic kind of preservationist's beauty.
When you started writing this book, was it obvious right away which neighborhoods you would look at?
No, this is a good question. My original intention was to write about each of the five boroughs. But as time went on, I saw that the crisis of authenticity, as I call it in the book, really is centered in Manhattan and Brooklyn now.
Will the increasing vacancy rates or the problems that some of these new houses are facing halt gentrification?
I think there will be a long lapse in gentrification, maybe stretching 10 years. But I expect that the periodic boom and bust cycle will take over at some point.
And so those buildings, as hated as they are by the locals, will eventually fill up.
I think
so. And we'll see the same sort of thing we saw in Soho, where Soho was made popular by the artists who were renting large lofts there, who have all pretty much been pushed out of the neighborhood because they can't afford the rents anymore.
Yes. Sociologists hate to make predictions, but I do think that we will see the new construction being housed and familiar.
On the other hand, that also means that new services are going to have to be made available.
Well, this is the big problem. Again, we tend in this city to go for the new housing before we go for the transportation infrastructure, the improvements to the subway, the public school system. We don't try to keep small neighborhood retail hubs in place. And I think that it would be great if we could tie our attraction to brand new buildings to a planning of a livable city.
What makes a neighborhood a prime candidate for gentrification? Is it that sense that it's authentic? In the case of Williamsburg, a neighborhood I grew up in, I never wanted to go back to, I always felt that it was kind of ugly, and I couldn't understand why people were moving there in droves.
Yes, Williamsburg does look like it belongs in New Jersey or Ohio, or definitely not.
Do not say New Jersey. I get complaints from New Jersey listeners who say, why are you always picking on New Jersey?
Okay, let's move outside the metropolitan area. But Williamsburg does not look like a standard New York City neighborhood. It's true, a lot of small houses, a lot of siding on the houses. And
plastic siding.
Those little
plastic awnings over doorways?
That's true. But once artists moved into Williamsburg, and more important, they opened up little shops, little restaurants, little art galleries that attracted a much broader public, Williamsburg began to look and feel different. It was no longer your mother's Williamsburg.
And it became a destination place.
Absolutely.
Because people wanted to go there and eat at the hot new restaurant. What about schools and other aspects of the infrastructure?
Well, we desperately need to pay attention to transportation and education. Employers say, big employers say, they think twice about locating in New York City because of transportation, the commute, and the quality of the workforce. We have to prepare the people in the city, not just build new buildings.
Schools always seem to be the last places to be adjusted to change.
Absolutely. Schools, unfortunately, are an afterthought.
So what do you propose? Should the city be at the forefront of this, or should we just try to halt gentrification, keep things the way they used to be?
I think it would be fantastic if the city built on the authenticity that remains by trying to keep people and small stores in place. Whether this requires some kind of limitation on housing prices or some sort of credit guarantees or a planning so that each neighborhood has a certain amount of affordable housing for people who already live in the neighborhood, that's what we need.
But you did say earlier that rent control had been a problem in the past. So how do you keep housing prices down without imposing something like rent control or rent stabilization?
Ah, I did not say rent control was a problem. I said rent control is a dirty word. For some reason, maybe having to do with free market ideology, people are very resistant to thinking about limiting increases in housing prices.
Sharon Zukin's latest book is called Naked City, The Death and Life of Authentic Urban Places. It's published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.